This is Wide Open, a series on how to embrace change and challenge your ways of thinking so you can level up your life, open up to new experiences, and pay it forward to those who need it. I'm your host, Tony Gonzalez. All right, today's guest is Ryan Holiday, Stoic philosopher, only 32 years old, which is young to be somewhat of this big thinker and a person that is doing lectures around the world, and big names are reaching out to him to tap into his mindfulness and his stoicism, his philosophies. So, you know, kudos to him, first of all. But after this conversation, you see why. First of all, he's read over 2,000 books. I know he doesn't like to keep a number, but it sounds like he's reading 250 books a year or something, which is crazy. When you consume that type of knowledge, you can't help but be wiser and be better for it. And we get into that actually at the top of the conversation. We talk all about what books do for you and how they impact you to make you a better version of yourself. To me, if you're ever looking for a shortcut to success, just go out there and start reading some books. I'm telling you, first of all, it's fun, but the knowledge that you get out of it, and it takes a little time to get used to it. But anyway, we get all into that. And it was a great conversation. We talk about stillness. We talk about mindfulness, how to keep a quiet mind and a quiet heart in this noisy world of ours, and little tricks on how to do that, you know, with social media, with news, the news cycles. And we talk about fake news and the benefits of that, and like how you can manipulate the system, which he tells his story on how he learned how to do that. So it's just a fascinating conversation. These are the type of conversations that I love when I meet people. If we can get to this level of conversation, that's a good night for me. So you guys are really going to enjoy this one. So stay tuned and enjoy. Hey guys, welcome back to the next episode of Wide Open the Podcast. I'm your host, Tony Gonzalez, and today my guest is Ryan Holiday. He's written 9 books. I thought it was 10 at the beginning, Ryan, but it is 9. You're on your way. I'm sure 10 will be coming here pretty soon. But Ryan is, first of all, his latest book is called Stillness is the Key. And I'll tell you what, folks, this is a great one. I've really, really enjoyed it. I ain't gonna lie to you, I'm not completely done with
all
it.
All right, all right.
But I've read more than half of it, and it is an outstanding, standing book on all things that we talk about on this show. So I'm really excited for this conversation to kick off, because there's going to be a lot of knowledge to learn in this one. So Ryan, thank you first of all for being on the show. Appreciate you coming out.
Yeah.
All the way from Texas, from Tejas. But we'll get into that too, because this guy, you live on a farm, right?
I do.
But we'll talk about that all later. Tell me about reading, because I had read, and is it true that you've read over 2,000 books by the time you were 25 or something like that?
I don't know what the number would be, but let's say it's called a lot. It's bad form to count, let's say. I'm sort of always reading, and I think
as a child too, right?
Growing up,
when did that start with the reading?
I remember in fourth grade, I don't remember when I really started getting into reading, but I do have this memory. I remember in fourth grade, I got in trouble because I was reading during class instead of paying attention. I kept getting in trouble. I was like, why am I paying attention to any of this? This is of no use to me. But what I love is inside books. And so it's sort of from there, it's been off to the races. I mean, I have some advantages now as an author, because professionally, like, my job is to read books. But I always found it interesting when I had jobs, it would be like, okay, if I sat at my computer and I read ESPN, people would think I was working. But if they came into my office and I had my feet up and I was reading a book, even if this book gave me ideas that substantially improved the business or made me a better boss or a better employee or whatever, they'd be like, I don't pay you to read books. You know? So I always sort of very much didn't like that, and sort of decided that, like, I was going to make reading a very much a part of my sort of like daily professional existence. So I've just always been reading, and I'm always in the middle of a book. You know, on the car ride here, I was reading a book.
And you speed read? Did you learn technique like Jim Quick style? Where you're like,
I know Jim, and he's great. I sort of, I don't want to say I'm morally opposed to speed reading, but like, I do feel like to me, reading is like food or sex. Like, the point isn't to like get it done quickly. Uh-huh. Like, the point is to enjoy it, right?
Sometimes, though, maybe. I don't know.
No, but the point is to it is a meditative practice or experience. So I'm not trying to rush through it, but I do find, to me, the best trick for reading quickly is reading a lot. So like, I would imagine in your experience, this tracks is like, the first book you read when you decided like, hey, I'm gonna really get into reading, it was slow. But the more you read, the faster you get, because you're bringing not like, you're like, oh, I already know about this. I can sort of skip through. Like, you bring the more understanding and the stronger your base of knowledge that you bring to a book is, the faster it is. And I notice like this with my books, people, when I'm talking about someone they've never heard of, the book is slow going. But when they're more well-versed in history, they're faster at reading because they know the names, they know the places, that sort of thing. So the more you read, the faster you get at it. It compounds.
And most people know my story. I was telling you before we came on, reading has absolutely changed my life. I would not be sitting here, and I would not have been a Hall of Fame football player. I would not have been good at most things that I'm pretty good at now if it wasn't for reading. Like the advantages that it gives you, where you can take all the books that you've read, and Stillness is the Key is your latest book. Yeah. Like all the knowledge you've learned, you've poured into this book, all this wisdom that you've learned. And now I get to sit there and take 5 hours out of my schedule over whatever period of time and devour what you have been devouring, what took you a whole lifetime to learn. No. I don't understand why more people don't read.
Tolstoy has this quote. He's like, I cannot understand people who refuse to converse with the wisest people who ever lived. Mm-hmm. And that's what, like, the other one from Mark Twain, he says, people who do not read have no advantages over people who cannot read.
Yeah.
And so I think we do make a bad, when we talk to kids or when we talk to students, we make a bad case for reading. So what we say is like, oh, The Great Gatsby is a beautiful piece of literature. We talk about how important reading is, like culturally, but we don't go like, no, there's an ROI. Like you're paying $15 to get hundreds, if not thousands of hours of really smart thinking poured into 5 hours of stuff. Like, human beings, recorded history, is like about 5,000 years. So we have about 5,000 years of books. Uh-huh. That's a lot of wisdom. Why would you be like, oh, I'm going to wing it, figure it out by myself? But that's really what people do. Oh. And like, just when you, like, so Warren Buffett said that the greatest investment he ever made was he bought this book called The Intelligent Investor in like 1960. It was a book by Benjamin Graham. But that's what taught him his investing strategy. So like, the second richest man in the world's best investment was a book. And then people go like, reading's expensive. Or they go like, I don't have time. You got to make time.
Yeah, make your time.
Books are free at the library.
So you grew up obviously reading.
Yeah.
What are some of those big influences? Because now Stoicism is your philosophy, right? That's kind of what you, is that a religion?
No, it's a philosophy.
It's just a philosophy.
It's a philosophy. So, There's no 10 commandments of Stoicism. Uh-huh. There's no sense of like, God said you have to do X. Yeah. I think what's actually interesting about Stoicism is that it is making a very logical case for a lot of the same things that are in religions, and therefore makes them compatible. Like, just as a crazy aside, Seneca, one of the sort of well-known Stoic philosophers, and Jesus are born in the same year. Mm-hmm. So they're walking, like, all this stuff is happening around the same time, and it's all sort of influencing each other. But Stoicism happens to be the philosophy I tend to write about most of my books, but there's been all sorts of influences. Like, I see you have Robert Greene over there.
Yeah.
Robert Greene was, I picked up the 48 Laws of Power in high school, and it was just like, what is this? Mm-hmm. Like, if you think about how many books a book like that is made of, like this guy goes out and he surveys all of history, all of literature, and he reduces it down to 48 laws of how sort of power and strategy and influence work. And I just read that and I was like, oh my God, like, this is incredible. Like, I didn't know any of these things even existed. And that kicked off for me probably hundreds of other books that I've read since that I heard about there for the first time. So like, I kind of try to see every book as like a door into a whole subject matter or, you know, set of ideas that I didn't know about before.
Uh-huh. So what are some of the Stoics out there? Like, give me some famous Stoics.
So I think the most well-known Stoic that people have probably heard of is Marcus Aurelius.
Marcus Aurelius. Now, is he in the movie?
Yes.
What Gladiator is about, Marcus Aurelius.
Yes, he's the old guy at the beginning of the movie Gladiator that Joaquin Phoenix's character kills.
Yeah.
Crazy thing, Marcus Aurelius did have a son named Commodus who was quite awful. Like, Joaquin Phoenix is probably underplaying how messed up Marcus Aurelius' son is. But why I bring up Marcus Aurelius is, okay, here, when we think philosopher, we think like nerd or academic or theoretical or abstract. Mm-hmm. Actually, the most prominent sort of philosopher in history is the emperor of Rome. So he doesn't have like, he's not teaching students. He's like trying to apply these things in the most high stress job there is. Then there's another famous Stoic named Epictetus, who's actually a slave who becomes a philosopher. There's Seneca, who's a businessman and a political advisor and a playwright. There's a Stoic named Chrysippus, who's a long distance runner.
Uh-huh.
There's one named Cleanthes, who's a boxer. Uh-huh. So like, the Stoics were not your stereotypical philosopher. These were real people in the real world who were using philosophy like to get better at whatever it was they were doing.
Okay, great. And before we get into to more of that, because I want to, I think I'm jumping ahead. I'm looking at my people over here. They're like, hey, don't go too fast. But more about you though.
Okay.
So you dropped out of school at 19.
Yes.
Why would you drop out of school at 19?
So I wanted to be a writer. Uh-huh. And so when I was in college, I was writing for the college newspapers, doing all this stuff. And through a bunch of things, I ended up meeting Robert Greene, like my hero as a writer.
The 48
yeah.
laws of power.
And I became his research assistant. Yeah. And so it was it's not quite as glamorous as like declaring for the draft, like leaving college to declare for the draft. But it was the equivalent of deciding to like sort of go pro at whatever the thing I was doing, much, much less lucratively, let's say, because I was a research assistant, but it was a chance to kind of like apprentice under someone who is a master of the profession rather than sort of studying it in school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you recommend that for young kids like that?
It depends.
Because people ask me all the time, they're like, hey, if you're good enough, because I'll tell them, look, if you're good enough to go pro right away and you're your first round, second round draft choice, and it's the same thing, like go get it.
I think it's complicated. So I get lots of emails from kids that are like, I'm going to drop out of college. And I'm sort of 2 minds. So one, it's like if they're failing out of, like when they're like, you know, I just got, you know, put on academic probation, but I go, okay, failing out of college and leaving college to do something better are not the same thing. If you can't figure out how to navigate college, I think you're going to have a really tough time navigating the real world. Because college is way easier than the real world. But if you have a clear sense of what you want to do and you have an opportunity to go do it, I'm bullish on it. And I'm definitely not a big fan of people racking up obscene amounts of debt, you know, to then have to start at the bottom of their profession, whatever that profession is. So like, not only did I leave to go get my really first shot as a writer, but I was not paying for the privilege of not doing that.
Uh-huh. And so you go there.
Yeah.
But then you go get a job at American Apparel, right?
Yeah.
And that's not writing though. That's marketing now.
Yeah. So I was sort of pursuing these two things simultaneously. I really wanted to be a writer, and I was also just fascinated with marketing. And this is sort of kind of the early days of blogging and social media. And I'd sort of experimented with some stuff, and I made some relationships, and I'd sort of gotten my foot in at the bottom floor of this sort of thing that was happening. Mm-hmm. And through Robert actually was on the board of directors of American Apparel, which is one of the cool things about being an author. You get all these cool opportunities. And so I ended up meeting the CEO of American Apparel. He ended up hiring me for like a small project, which turned into a big project, which turned into a bigger project. And the reason I ended up sort of taking this detour as a marketer was ultimately, if you're pursuing some sort of creative work, you have to figure out how to sell this to people. Mm-hmm. And that's one problem that artists and even like, you know, great computer programmers or inventors have. They're really good at making stuff. And then they just think the world is a meritocracy and people will magically find. Uh-huh. Like in sports, it is nice that there's so much effort spent trying to discover and cultivate talent.
Yeah.
Almost nothing else is like, the rest of the world is not like that at all. Uh-huh. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, a VC is not going to beat on your door and beg to give you money.
Yeah.
And customers are not going to beat on your door begging to buy your product. You have to figure out how to sell these things. And so I just realized that as a writer, eventually the rubber has to meet the road. You have to figure out how to promote and sell these things. And uh-huh. So I did that for a long time.
Now, as a writer, first of all, I think that's actually probably the best thing for you, right? The best thing that ever happened to you is to take a little detour.
Yes.
I believe that just like in sports, I think what made me a great athlete is that I surfed when I was a kid. I did skateboarding. I played volleyball. I did all the different stuff. I played basketball, obviously a big part of me, which makes me ultimately a better football player, which is what I ended up doing. And I think that's kind of like what a lot of kids should do. You should go out there and just try as much stuff as you can, because it's only going to help you when you eventually figure out what you want to do.
Book recommendation. Have you read David Epstein's Range?
I'm reading that right now.
Oh, yeah. So good. Yeah. And that's exactly what he's talking about. Yeah. You have to develop a range of skills and experiences, especially at, like, if you want to be a business person or a creative, or you want to be a writer or an investor, like you have to have an understanding of how the world works and a breadth of knowledge or insights that you then channel into your work. You know what I mean? So many people, like, okay, so let's say as a writer, it's like you go to undergrad and then you go get an MFA and then you write for a newspaper, blah, 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 blah. But the problem is you don't have anything to say because you haven't lived it all. You've just been studying the craft, which is really important. But I was just reading the Bruce Springsteen biography, and you're like, oh, like he could have written this in crayon and all the words could be misspelled and it would still be good because it's about this fascinating life. Mm-hmm. And so you have to go out and do things just in the way that a comedian can't live on their private plane and retreat to their mansion. They have to go out and like experience the frustrations and the ridiculousness of life to create the material that they then talk about on stage.
Yeah.
And so, I think range is really important. Experiences are really important. And I mean, a good chunk of my book on ego was driven by the experience that I saw this high flying company then, you know, implode and take itself down.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of the story I heard about an actor, Sean Penn, that he smokes and drinks when he was younger. I don't know if he's doing it anymore. He smokes and drinks. And they're like, why do you do that? Why do you tear your body up like that? And he's like, because I'm preparing for roles that are coming, that I got to be able to go to that emotion. I can't fake. Because when I'm acting, I can't fake it. Yeah. Like, I have to have been there and had that experience. So I think that's really, really interesting. So speaking of interesting, your book, Trust Me, I'm Lying.
Yes.
And this is when you were marketing. Tell me all about what that means and how you applied that to your job at the time.
Well, so that was the interesting part, is I knew I was doing this marketing thing because eventually I wanted to be a writer, but I also kind of always had my eye on like, what's going on? What do I have to say? What have I experienced? What point of view do I have? And so working as a marketer for all these sort of really provocative, you know, sort of controversial brands, I kind of got this peek like behind the curtain of like how the media system really works. And so what that book is kind of an expose of like how, you know, like it's like, you know, you don't want to see how the sausage gets made kind of a thing. Yeah. And so the book is, you know, I was writing in 2012 about kind of like fake news and about how media can be manipulated and how the things that start on social media end up driving the news cycle and what it feels like to be caught in a scandal or to create a publicity stunt. So it's kind of a dark, messed up book.
Now, in the book, you're saying this is how it's done? Or is it like a play-by-play? This is how you create fake news.
Yeah.
And the results of when you do create this fake news.
Yeah. And the it's sort of a cautionary tale. I was thinking of it as like, okay, every once in a while you'll hear of like a computer hacker that like breaks into the FBI. They don't steal anything. They're just like, this is a problem. You guys got to fix this, right? That's sort of the intention I felt like I was bringing to the book is like, look, you guys understand how this works? Like, this is not good, right? And it was interesting. The book was really, really controversial when it came out. It got a lot of attention and there was a lot of shooting the messenger, let's say. And then people kind of mostly didn't listen.
Can you give me an example of fake news working magic for somebody?
So like I'll give you one of the stories I opened the book with. I was working on a movie campaign for an author. And so what we did was we bought two billboards on La Cienega and Olympic. They were
in Los Angeles.
They were deliberately very offensive. And then we also bought some in Chicago. So we bought two sets of billboards. We put them up. You pay someone to put them up. Then I went and I vandalized them myself. I put this obscene message on them. Then I took a picture of it. Then I anonymously sent this picture to a blog. Then it starts getting picked up everywhere. And then the ads were banned in Chicago. So the point was we basically paid, you know, let's say $2,000 for these billboards. And then it became a national news story about how this controversial billboard campaign was creating a backlash. And then the advertisements had been banned because they were so offensive. And then, you know, the Washington Post does an editorial about it. The news starts covering it. It became this huge thing for a grand total of like $2,000 to pay for the amount of coverage or exposure that we would have gotten. You know, it would have been hundreds of thousands of dollars. And like, again, I think you could talk about this non-politically. In the 2016 election, Trump gets something like $2 billion worth of free publicity, because he doesn't really care what people say about him as long as he's the center of attention. And so it shouldn't surprise us that brands and public figures deliberately sort of abuse this system all the time.
It's like releasing a sex tape, right?
Yes.
It's like the old, who's the first one to ever do it?
Paris Hilton,
right? I mean, and look, that was released on purpose, right? Isn't that what that came out?
I don't know if but Kim Kardashian definitely released hers on purpose, and she's a billionaire. Yeah. I mean, like, this is how this works, right?
Oh, man.
And so I think people sit back and they watch the news and they think this is a reflection of reality, and it kind of is, but it's also a reflection of what people want you to see because it's good for them.
That sounds...
It's a dark
book. Ridiculous. It makes me icky inside. It makes me say, but as a Stoic, I mean, does that go against Stoic philosophy?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm 22 when this is all happening.
Yeah. First of all, you're only 32 years old, right?
Yeah.
Which is crazy, but.
So it was it's a period I look back on and I have certain sort of regrets about, but, ultimately, where I came from writing the book was a place of like, do people understand how this works and how easily it can be abused?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're now seeing is people are starting to wake up to the costs of having a media system that, you know, is primarily free, that's primarily driven by like clicks and shares and. That's sort of designed to provoke us constantly. It doesn't lead to a good place.
Yeah.
So I feel like I came from it as a place of like sort of ringing the warning bell. Whether everyone interprets it that way or not is not really something I control. But that's what I know. I was sitting there writing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're saying, okay, I gotta let everybody know
fixed.
You're being bullshitted.
Yes.
By the way.
Yeah.
And so how do you cut through that though? I mean, how do you recognize, or is it something you just take it at face value? And I mean, because when I saw all the sex tape stuff, I thought it was real and I was, you're like appalled, but it is attention. So how do you cut through that noise?
Well, when I talk about this, not to skip ahead in the new book, I mean, I think people consume way too much news. Right? Like they consume way too much news.
What do you mean by that?
Like, so people think that the news is how you become an informed citizen, when really they'd be better off reading biographies or, you know, reading history books. Like, no, understanding the trivia of the moment is not being informed. How many people could tell you exactly what, you know, Trump or so-and-so tweeted or what the breaking story on CNN was? And then if you really sort of quiz them on like how our system of government works, They have no idea, right? And so I sort of urge people to think bigger picture and to think longer term and to study sort of information that's not in real time, but information that's likely to have a long shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
I think people consume way too much news. I think about this with sports, right? Like, I love watching sports, but me watching SportsCenter on Tuesday speculating about whether so-and-so is going to play or not has no bearing on whether the doctors clear them to play or not, right? Uh-huh. So we do this with the news. We watch, you know, how are they going to respond to this, yeah. right? Like, they'll either respond or they won't, right? Or like, is he going to be impeached? He will or he won't, right? Uh-huh. Like, people are consuming the information because it feels like you're participating
mm-hmm.
when really you're just watching people give you their opinions.
So what do you do then? Do you listen to the news?
I don't watch any television news. I think television news is designed to mostly make you want to watch more television news.
Okay.
Like, when you go to the airport, did you know CNN has a deal with most of the major airports in the United States that pays them to run CNN on all those screens in the airport. So, uh-huh. so when you're at the airport, you could be sitting there reading a book. You uh-huh. could be sitting there talking to your kids. You could be there, just having some quiet alone time. Instead, you're glued, you know, to whatever the latest outrage is. So I opt out of that entirely.
Uh-huh.
When I do,
you don't have it on your phone.
No.
You obviously, you're not going looking for it, but you cut it off on your phone.
I cut it off on my phone. I don't use social media on my phone.
You don't have social media now.
I have social media. I don't have it on my phone.
On your phone.
Right. Because I don't want to be scrolling the feed and seeing. Again, the news is I guess of some value. People's opinion about the news is like of even less value, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't do that. And then I pay for the New York Times, but I try to consume it with a lag time. So like I don't want to read it five times a day. I want to maybe check in once or twice a week.
Uh-huh.
And I want to read the important things that have stood, uh-huh. right? Are they going to announce it today? Are they going to announce it tomorrow? What do you think the announcement? This is not news. This is opinion. And a lot of times, I mean, I'm sure you see this with sports. You'll get on one of these panels and you realize like half these people don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Like they've never been on the field, right? What they're saying runs completely counter to your direct experience as an athlete. And people at home are just, you know, eating it up, like thinking that this is the truth, and it's not.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, let's go into stillness now.
Okay.
Let's start talking about kind of the keys of stillness.
All right.
Well, first of all, what is stillness?
I mean, I think stillness is something that manifests itself in a lot of different forms, right? Mm-hmm. There's the stillness of waking up early before the house is stirring. I think that's mm-hmm. a wonderful form of stillness. There's this stillness when you are like in the zone playing, right? Uh-huh. Like when your training meets the exact right moment, and you've tuned everything out and you're totally present. That's a form of stillness. There's the stillness I feel when I'm writing. There's the stillness you feel when you go out for a walk, right? There's the stillness of swimming laps in a pool. And there's the stillness of meditating. There's the stillness of, you know, quiet alone. There's lots of different forms of mm-hmm. it. But to me, stillness is this place that most of the great that we are seeking, whether it's in the form of personal happiness or professional excellence, stillness is the place that all that comes from.
Okay. And so we just got done talking about the news cycles. Yeah. You got done talking about social media. This is all stuff that causes noise, which is and chaos, which is the opposite of stillness.
Totally.
So now that we know what stillness is, how do you quiet your mind? How do you get to that place consistently in this noisy world that we have?
Yeah. I think routine is a great way to do it. I think there's a reason athletes are such habits of routine.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to eliminate unnecessary choices, right? It's like, this is what I do. This is the order that it goes in, right? It's like it's about sort of creating structure within the chaos.
Mm-hmm.
But I think routine is also a way that you get into a rhythm mm-hmm. and it turns the mind off a little bit, right? So like in the mornings, I get up early and the first thing I do is I take my son for a walk. We go on a long walk. And I do this before I touch the phone. Huh. And that process of, it, paradoxically, I'm moving, but I'm getting into stillness. And on mornings where, because I have to do something else or, it's raining, mm-hmm. I can feel the absence of that stillness. Like my heart is beating faster. My mind is racing more. because I didn't get into that routine. So I think routine is a huge part of it. Uh-huh. How do you eliminate, like the person who's having to decide every moment what they're going to do or not do has a lot less stillness than, you know, Obama famously had two suits. He would choose between like gray and blue. Uh-huh. And you remember that time when he wore a brown suit and like everyone lost their mind?
Did they? I don't remember.
Yeah, yeah. It was crazy. But the point is like, how do you, like Steve Jobs, he only wore a black turtleneck because like he didn't want to have to, I think not only was he like, I don't want to have to think about what I'm going to wear, but also he didn't want to waste time going shopping.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so how do you sort of, how do you narrow your focus down to the things that matter?
I feel the same way, but my wife, she's like, no, you need to stop wearing those jeans. Stop wearing that t-shirt. She sounds just like that. Dude. I'm not kidding. You're married,
sure
though, right?
I'm sure she appreciates that impression. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. Okay. You're married. How long have you been married now?
I've been married 4 years.
4 years.
But we've been together for going on 12.
So going on 12 years, two kids.
Yes.
And they're younger too, it sounds like.
Yeah, 3 and 4 months.
So yeah, so because you're taking them on walks. So I was like, okay.
Yes, yeah. They don't have a choice right now.
How do you achieve stillness in your home life? With the two kids and the business and the wife and the, you know, all the stuff that comes along with that.
Well, it's important, I think, when we're talking about stillness, that we're talking about stillness there. This, like, look, in some respects, it's easy to be still on a 30-day silent meditation retreat. Like, you don't have anything going on, right? So I'm interested in, like, how is Marcus Aurelius still when he's running the frickin' empire, right? Yeah. Or how are you still when, you know, it's fourth down and you guys are going for it. Like, how do you do stillness in the real world? And I think parenting is one of the least still things there is. Absolutely. So how do you find it? I think weirdly, because I talk to lots of young people about it and they're like, you know, I don't have time for a relationship or I don't have room for a relationship. I want to focus on my career. I actually find having had a partner for my entire writing career has been a huge source of stillness, right? Because, you know, I'm negotiating this contract and I'm taking it personally and I'm worked up and you have someone to run these things by, right? Yeah. Like having a partner, to me, especially if you're like an ambitious, driven person, is hugely important because it prevents you from spinning off the planet, right? So I think my wife's a big part of me getting there rather than like some people might go, how do you have time for that? It's like, no, this is like a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of it. But I think one of the things that I've learned having kids is it, I was watching some, or I was reading some, the new David Brooks book, The Second Mountain, which is very good. And he was saying that when his son was born, someone sent him a letter and they said, welcome to the world of unavoidable reality. Uh-huh. And what they meant is that like, and I've experienced this now, is like kids, like you're not in control, kids are in control. Like their nap schedule is in control of what you're doing. Yeah. Or like the fact that they're sick is in control of what you're doing, or their soccer practice is in control of what you're doing. It doesn't matter if you're—
Or their diapers full of poop.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you're a billionaire or it doesn't matter if you're a Pro Bowler. Like they're in control. And like that's actually been really sort of humbling for me, and it's helped slow things down because instead of me being like, I decide what's going on, you have to kind of be like, there's a level of just going with the flow on all this, right? And so like kids and routine both clash, but also like kids illustrate the importance of routine. So I don't know, it's been a deeply educational, humbling process for me for sure.
Can you give me some... I'm looking for the strategies, the takeaways. Like, okay, I get I need stillness in my life. Yeah. How do you do it though? I know you said you take walks, but what's the inner dialogue in your brain?
So what's
happening
there? The walk is number one. And what I'm trying to, I'm not taking the phone and I'm trying to go like, this is what I'm doing. That's something I say to myself a lot. Like, this is what I'm doing. It's a kind of a mantra I repeat.
This is what I'm doing. Okay.
Yeah. Like I'm taking a walk.
Presence.
I'm right? Yeah. Yeah. I'm not taking a walk and trying to figure this thing out at the same time. I'm not taking a walk and doing, I'm not even exercising. I'm just taking the walk. Right. Uh-huh. So I try to be present on the walk. I try to notice things. I try to be aware and present. And then actually the first thing I do when I get home, because I feel like I've gotten into a good space from the walk, is I sit down with a journal. I think journaling is a very underrated, cheap accessible tool for anyone that's trying to sort of clear their mind or maybe deal with destructive thoughts that they have.
Uh-huh.
Because like you're putting these thoughts down, and then you're looking at them literally from a distance. Like it's maybe only a foot or two, but like you are writing like, I'm angry about X. Uh-huh. And then you're having a conversation with yourself about whether it's good to be angry about that and okay. whether you want that anger to continue. So I kind of have like a dialogue with myself in the morning in my journal.
Uh-huh.
And it's been a huge breakthrough for me. It prevents me from stewing on things. It's like, I want to take whatever baggage I have and I want to set it down on those pages.
Uh-huh.
So the journal is a big thing for me. And then the next, I go right into the work. Like I want to do the most important thing I have that day as early as possible in the day. Wow. Before I'm in that kind of reaction mode.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I feel like that's where most people are most of the time.
In reaction mode.
They're in reaction mode. They uh-huh. start the day on their back foot, right?
Yeah.
They wake up. The first thing they do is look at their phone, and their phone has a bunch of texts, a bunch of emails, a bunch of news alerts.
Yeah.
And so the first thing they're thinking is like, I have to respond to all this.
Yeah.
To me, the better place is you wake up and you go, what is the main thing that I'm doing today? And how am I going to achieve that? And mm-hmm. that's the place I want to go. So it's like, I'm writing part two of Stillness is the Key today. I've got to get to this place.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the thoughts I want running through my head. Not, I can't believe Susie said that to me in an email mm-hmm. or whatever, you know, like,
yeah.
I can't believe Donald Trump tweeted that. Oh my God, did you see the market drop 50 points? I don't want to be there. I want to be in the, what am I trying to do today? And how can I get that win as early as possible?
Talk to me about desires.
Sure.
Like how do you, let's.
What kind of desires?
The desires, food.
Yeah.
Sex.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of all like the stuff that plagues most people.
Yeah. So
And how do you curb that when you come? And a lot of this stuff stems from our childhoods.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
And that's what I love about your book. You talk about that where, okay, well, this, like Tiger Woods, you give the example of Tiger Woods having this insatiable appetite for winning, a cold-blooded killer, because Earl, his father, taught him all this stuff when he was a kid. Like that really blew me away.
Dark, right?
Because we think we know Tiger Woods, but you go really into like what was there while he was growing up. But then when he gets older, you know, his dad had a mistress and would bring his, in fact, he is the child of the mistress
yes.
where his dad yeah. had three he older is. Children.
Yes.
So people that grow up and they're like, well, I grew up, it's just part of me now. So right. I can't help it. What do you say to people that say, I can't help it and I can't get out of this addictive behavior that I have? What do you do then?
So the sort of Zen metaphor is that like on the surface, the ocean looks calm, but beneath there's currents, mm-hmm. you know, there's like riptides. And this is kind of what they saw as like craving and desire is like that it threatens to disturb the stillness that you have. So I think Tiger Woods is a fascinating example of someone who like mentally on the golf course and physically on the golf course, complete mastery,
mm-hmm.
but spiritually clearly was, you know, wrestling with some very dark demons, right? Like, and I mean, I think one of the saddest things I found out in my research is that his dad referred to the idea of enough as the E word. Like
yeah.
there was never enough. And that's such a horrible lesson to teach a kid. It's not that winning isn't great and that you shouldn't strive to be the best that you can be, but the idea that you can never be satisfied, that you'll never feel good, that only weaklings ever feel content
yeah.
is a horrible thing, right? That's horrible. That's like if you were trying to create a formula for misery, that's literally what you would come up with, right? Mm-hmm. And so we all have desires. We all have issues or traumas from our childhood that are, I think, threatening whatever stillness we're able to get to mentally or through our routines or whatever. And so you have to like actively work on those things. You mm-hmm. can't like, you know, okay, if you just sit and meditate, maybe you're going to get to some place of stillness. Wonderful. But if deep down, all you want is your dad's approval or all you like, you so desperately need to hook up with as many women as possible because that's how you'll feel like a man, mm-hmm. that stillness is going to be very short-lived, right? And yeah. in fact, your success is going to be very short-lived because you're going to end up gambling it away to get those other things that you want. Mm-hmm. So, look, I think therapy is important. I think you have to actively go, like, look, I'm going to probe, like, I think what a lot of... Did you see the new Bill Burr special on Netflix?
I did.
You know, he talks about like the shelf of yeah. anger. He's like, yeah. you just shove
you
it
just
down.
Push it down there like yeah. a man, be yeah. a man and push it down there.
That's yep. so like, and like we all do that and men and women do that. Yeah. But like eventually that comes exploding out.
Yeah.
And so you gotta decide like, I'm gonna look in there. I'm gonna uh-huh. look in there and I'm gonna work on it because the goal is not, like moments of stillness, but like enduring, like sustainable stillness.
Yeah, yeah, which is
really hard.
And this is something I've been working on for years. Sure. And I could find it on the football field.
Yeah.
But to find it off the field, it's been tough. It's been tough. But it's one of those things. How long? Let's say somebody out there, worst case scenario is like, I'm full of envy. I have yeah. anger. I can't control my desires. I drink or whatever. I smoke. And I'm just having a hard time. Like yeah. where do I begin?
I don't know. That's a really tough question. I mean, maybe what I try to do is I try to start, like, you know, Dave Ramsey talks about like, he's like a sort of a personal finance expert, but he's like, line all your debts up. Right? Like he's like, line them up and let's start with the smallest one. And you just cross them off one by one. Uh-huh. Right. So the problem is people get so intimidated by all this shit they have to do uh-huh. that they kind of despair or they try to tackle a little of it all at the same time. They don't make any progress. Uh-huh. And so, I mean, one way to do it might be to go like, okay, what problem am I going to tackle? You know, like I'm going to quit drinking. Yeah. I'm going to quit drinking for a month. Right. Yeah. Like for me with the phone thing, I found I was like being reactive in the morning. I was just starting. So I used this app called Spar and we did a challenge and it was like, you had to not use your phone for the first 10 minutes in the morning. You just start with 10 minutes. But if you use your phone, it charges you like $10. And so it was like I don't want to lose $10, right? Uh-huh. Even though the money doesn't matter. It's like the game of it uh-huh. was exciting. And so it was like, I started with 10. And now I can go sometimes till lunch, like without touching it. Uh-huh. And that like, so I think you start really small. And it might be like, hey, I'm gonna go to therapy. Or hey, I'm just gonna cut this horrible person who makes me unhappy out of my life.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's mom or dad, or maybe that's a bad relationship that you're in. But I think you start small. And I just want people to think like stillness is this holistic thing we're doing. So the decision to get out of a relationship that makes you unhappy is not just a personal, it's affecting all parts of your life. And it will might make you a better athlete. It might make you a better investor. It could make you a better parent. It could all these things.
Okay. Well as an athlete, yeah. you said better athlete, your book has kind of resonated with teams and
it's
athletes.
Been really cool. Yeah.
Why do you think it's done so well with that genre?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it certainly wasn't what I was thinking when I was uh-huh. writing them, but I think there are a lot more athletes like you than you think. And uh-huh. coaches especially. Like I think what it's like a lot of the easy gains in sports have been figured out, like nutrition, training. You know, they break down film to such a level. It's not like people are magically discovering a new way to hit a baseball or to run an offense. So I think teams are now in all the different sports are really looking at sort of the mental and the wellness side of performance. Like even just the idea that was like, oh, sleep is important. You know what I mean? Like this is something teams figured out yeah. like within the last 10 years. It's crazy. Like, yeah. oh, hey, maybe if we don't like work them to the bone, they'll be more well-rested and play better. So I think the like, oh, there's lessons in these books is something that, that teams are increasingly picking up on. So my books it's been really cool to see them go through sports. But at the end of the day, I think like elite performance is elite performance. So the same reason that a Navy SEAL is reading a book or a CEO is reading a book is yeah. why you as a tight end are reading
a book.
Because
yeah.
you're like, it makes me better at what I do.
Yeah, and I know on the football field in anything that I've done, But really, it was easy for me when I was on the football field. Once I figured it out, the last 15 years of my career, I could get to that place of stillness when you're on the field where you're totally present. Sure. You're not worried about the past. You're not worried about the future. Yeah. You are in the moment and you're fearless.
Yeah.
And you know that you're gonna accomplish what you want. But the hard part is bringing that off the field. That's what I mean by athletes, because that's where we, and I'll say we, because I was one of them, I could do that during the game, but I couldn't do that when I got off the field.
No, I totally relate to that. I'll give you an example. It's like, okay, in my life, let's say I'm at home and you get in an argument with your wife and it's you have two differing opinions on how things should be. That's complicated, right? You don't have control over that. It's not going the way you want.
Yeah.
But I know I can go up to my computer and sit down and do my work and it's awesome.
Yeah.
Like I control that, right?
Yeah.
And so I think, especially in sports where so much is sort of catered for you and so many of the concerns of life are eliminated temporarily, it becomes like this safe space for you that's not real life, you know? And I have to remind myself all the time, like you can't run away and escape into your work. You have to figure out how to get this even when you have a crying baby at home. Mm-hmm. You have to do it even when the contractor is, 2 months late on the job they're working on, when your neighbor's blasting loud music. Like how do you cultivate that? Sports and writing and work is it's such a smaller universe, right? With fewer variables. So it's easier to get to that place. But yeah, I'm trying always to go like, look, I can't run away from this. I have to face this and I have to figure it out. And I have to remind myself of the same principles that serve me well in the work, which is like, don't extrapolate. Like this argument, just what is actually at stake here, right? Uh-huh. Like, don't go like, I don't want to be dealing with this intent. Like, the problem is you're extrapolating out into the future, right? It's like somebody's rude to you in the street. And you're like, you don't go like, okay, this person was rude to me. It took 8 seconds. Like, move on. You go like, I can't go through the world being treated like this. What if I let everyone treat
me
like
this? I'm offended.
And so that's the opposite of being present. You are flashing forward to the future or you're reacting to how things have been in the past. If you could actually see this for what it is, an ordinary person in a, meaningless encounter on the street, you'd be able to let it go. And the nice part is the lessons or the principles that serve you well, and whether it's in writing or in business or in sports, they work in the rest of the world. They're just more difficult to apply.
Uh-huh. So, okay, I'll ask you that question then. You're driving down the street like all of us do, and you got the guy or the woman that happens, and they cut you off.
Yeah.
And, the finger gets thrown or whatever it is that the anger comes or whatever. How do you calm down in that moment? What technique do you do?
So when people hear the word stoic, they think like no reaction, no emotions. What the Stoics go is like, look, there's involuntary reactions. So it's like, if I jumped out from behind a wall and scared you, you have no ability to stop yourself from feeling scared in that moment. But 20 minutes later, if you're still worked up about it, that's on you, right? If I throw cold water on you, you're going to have a biological, physical reaction. But like at a certain point, you regain back control. Uh-huh. And so even just thinking about it that way, right? The decision that's like, okay, this person cut me off. They scared me. You got that, oh crap. Your heart rate goes up. So you're going to have your 5 second reaction. What Stoicism is concerned with is not stopping that 5 second reaction.
Uh-huh.
But the decision to chase after them in your car as you honk and flip them off and retaliate, that's on you, right? So I try to go like, I try to think about that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like it's the, like, look, if somebody you love passes away, this is sad. Grief is an involuntary reaction and totally natural and totally fine. But if 2 years later, you still can't get out of bed.
Yeah.
You got to sit and have a conversation with yourself about, is this really what they would want? Uh-huh. Who is this helping? The fact that you lost them means you also have to lose 2 years of your life, right? So Stoicism is kind of this inner dialogue with yourself about the decisions that I'm making, is this who I want to be? Like the Stoic thing is like, you don't control what happens. Uh-huh. So you don't control other people. You don't control that there's assholes in the world. You don't control, there's evil people in the world, but you control how you respond.
Yeah.
And so let's focus on that.
Yeah. I think that's why this does translate so well to teams, because coaches talk about that, because you can't. Like, you're going to get the guy that's going to hit you illegally. You're going to get stuff is going to happen. But it's up to you to keep your cool.
Yes.
Take a deep breath. That's what I do. That's my little trick, is like, okay, I'm going to do a little 4 second breathing, you know, 4 seconds in, 4 seconds out, and get back to a baseline. And then you find that, okay, well, you just forget about that. Who gives a shit?
And I think bigger fish to fry. Another word for baseline is like equanimity, right? Like poise.
Uh-huh.
And that's stillness. Like, that's the equanimity, equanimitas in Latin. That's what stillness is. So that baseline, like, even just the idea of a baseline is a really great strategy. It's like, here's where I am. Yes, occasionally I go like this, but I always want to be getting back to that middle level.
Uh-huh. I'm looking at your tattoo just now. Yeah. Ego is the enemy.
Yeah, if ego is the enemy, the obstacle is the way, and then stillness is the key.
Stillness is the key. Look at all your, these are your,
These are mantras I try to think, like, the idea is, like, I swam this morning, and I love being able to look at them as I'm swimming.
Yeah,
and
just to remind you, right?
Yeah.
Just little, it's kind of like journaling every day, right? You're just, just getting it there, getting it seen.
And the idea is, like, look, there's no situation in which there's not some advantage that can be gained. Right, that's the obstacles away. There's no situation that ego makes better. That's the idea of ego. Uh-huh. And then stillness to me is the key that unlocks whatever I'm trying to do.
Memento mori.
Memento mori.
Am I saying that right?
Memento mori.
That's on you too.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah. So it means remember death. Remember that you are mortal. Here, I'll show you. I have. Uh-huh. I'll give you one. I carry this coin in my pocket.
Uh-huh.
And it's this idea that. On the back, there's a quote from Marcus Aurelius. He says, you could leave life right now. Let that determine what you do and say and think. So you got that big skull over there, right?
Yep.
In most sort of like Renaissance paintings, there was always like a picture of a philosopher. They always have a skull in the corner of the painting. And the skull is a reminder that, like, we are mortal, fragile beings, that we can go at any moment. Uh-huh. And this isn't supposed to be morbid. It's supposed to remind us that you can't take anything for granted, right? One of the darkest, sort of most difficult things in all of Marcus Aurelius' meditations is he's like, you should even think this as you tuck your children into bed at night.
Really?
And he goes like, but isn't that like tempting fate? And he's like, no, the point is, like, don't rush through this.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I catch myself doing that all the time. You go like, come on, it's time for bed. And it's like, why am I actually trying? Am I trying to put them in bed right now because, like, it's good for their health? Or is it that I have something paused on the TV that I want to watch?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, why are we rushing? And like, so when the Stoics are talking about death being this thing that's there, they're like, why are you rushing through this? Right?
Yeah.
Why are you being ungrateful for the guaranteed present moment that you have right now? When you should be experiencing it. And most of the, like, all the retired athletes I've talked to, I wonder if this lines up with your experience. Every single one of them is like, I wish I enjoyed it more.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, that I wish that I'd been more present for it. I wish I hadn't been so hard on myself or so focused on what I was going to do next. And I think that's a lesson we can all learn from.
Yeah, well, I think I enjoyed it.
You did?
I was 10 years single too.
Okay. No, but, do you know what I mean? Like,
oh, I know, everybody has their thing. My biggest thing was the fear of showing people who I really, really was. On the football field, I could do that, but in the locker room, that is my biggest regret. And so speaking of fears, what is your biggest fear?
My biggest fear? I don't know.
Because, and it's interesting because you're talking about your family. So obviously you contemplate death in a positive way to help you stay focused and appreciate life more.
Yeah.
So most people's biggest fear is probably death, dying or someone near them dying.
Yeah.
That's not a big fear for you.
No. I guess one of the things that I think about, let's say a little bit more professionally, is that I was very successful in my career early as a writer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I've written 10 books, I'm 32. There's that, and maybe actually you have some advice as an athlete, because the career span of athletes is so short. I'm worried about falling off.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and that fear, I think the important thing when we look at these fears is to ask, is this fear serving you well or is it harming you?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it mostly harms me because instead of being able to say, take my time or to think big picture, I'm doing out of that fear. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Fear is a good motivator.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much happiness is going to, it's going to bring you. I mean, fear got me through the first, you know, 23 years of my life. Dealing with it. And but eventually it has to move to love and to stillness. Like that's the way it's worked for me.
Yeah, that's great.
Where you can really, really enjoy things.
Yes.
Shoot, when I say 23, I mean probably 43. I mean, I'm 43 years old. It just happened. So it's one of those things that takes some time. But as soon as you move to the heart, at least for me, that's where I don't give a shit anymore. I don't care what tomorrow's bringing.
Yeah.
Because first of all, I know it's going to be good.
Yeah.
That's what I feel in my heart, but it's really about today. And if I can do my best today, then tomorrow will take care of itself.
So do you have any, how do you move from fear to love? What, is there anything you do or is it just time?
Yeah. I have, for me, and everybody's different. There's so many different ways to get there. I always say to people, you know, if we wanted to go to New York from LA, you could, there's many ways to get there.
That's
I mean,
great
I could
analogy.
Ride a bike there. Yeah. I could ride a skateboard. I could take a plane. I could do a lot of different ways to get there. I don't know who's to say is the best way, but for me, I like meditation.
Yeah.
I like contemplating with my heart, meaning I'll literally cover my heart with my hand and think and try to speak everything in my heart. And I just learned this technique.
Yeah.
And I try like to take what I learned during football
and
put that into this next stage of my life, which has been difficult.
Yeah.
Been difficult.
No, that's beautiful. I like that.
Okay, so final questions
now.
Okay. My producer's giving me the old wrap it up there. Three books, if you were on an island, three books that you would bring with you.
Are these books about surviving on this island or are they just about books? Like if I'm just choosing three books.
You know, you got to learn how to gut a pig and, and fillet it. No, I mean, just three books that you would enjoy reading, not about survival.
Okay, so I really like 48 Laws. Uh-huh. I think that's that would be a big one. Marcus Aurelius's Meditations would be number two. And then number three, I'm not sure what I would do. I think I'd pick a biography of some like sort of fascinating, fascinating, complicated figure whose like opinions, I'm reading a biography of Douglas MacArthur right now. And he's just sort of like larger than life figure. His flaws are absurd and is like, brilliance is also absurd. So I think I pick a biography of someone.
Okay. Well then kind of piggybacking that a little bit.
Okay.
You're having a dinner.
Yes.
You get to bring three guests.
Okay.
Who would you bring?
Ooh. Okay. Lincoln.
Uh-huh.
Let's go Lincoln. Let's go Marcus Aurelius. And then
of course, Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's like the subject of my life's work. It'd be weird if I said no.
Anybody? Iron Maiden? You got the Iron Maiden t-shirt on there?
I'll bring
the whole band.
I'll bring the whole band.
You got to have some fun. Yeah.
Dude, the lead singer of Iron Maiden, you know, he also flies the band from show to show in their own 757.
That means they've done really well.
Well, really well, but he's also a professional airline pilot.
Oh,
he flies.
Oh, he's paying.
Like the lead singer performs, and then he puts on his goggles and shit, and then he flies them.
Iron Man. So you're a heavy metal guy.
Yeah.
You know, so funny. A stoic loves heavy metal because that's like the most chaotic hardcore music
that's
out there.
True.
pretty cool. Yeah. I like that. What's a food you would like to make healthy?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm addicted to popcorn and nachos.
Nachos?
They're not terrible for you, but they're certainly not good for you.
Yeah, not terrible.
Yeah.
If
Steph Curry can eat a lot of popcorn, I can probably get away with it.
Let me see. Well, you're only 32.
Yeah.
What's your goal before 2020?
For 2020? I don't really have, I talk about this a little bit in the book. Like I'm actually trying to, I don't do goals.
You don't do goals.
I don't do goals. In the sense that I feel like sometimes we can get so focused on targets, like sports, it makes total sense. There's like objective measurements that you want to get. More in life, I'm just thinking like, I just want to do this thing that I do I want to continue to do it. Uh-huh. Right. So like, it's a writing is a stranger profession because the, you know, it's like, is the best book the one that sells the most copies? Like, obviously not. There's lots of terrible books that sell. Is it, what about these books that win awards, but nobody reads? That's not success. Right. And so it's like, I'm more focused, at least professionally, just on like, how do I keep doing this at a level where I'm getting better?
Yeah, I love that. I love doing this show because I can see successful people like yourself will come on here. And like I said, there's so many different ways to level up and be wide open and be the best for anyone. Like most people will say, you got to set goals. You got to start because you got to have a target.
Yeah.
How can you know where you're going if you don't have a target? But I love that philosophy because it works for you. And it might work for people out there listening. So
have you read Zen and the Art of Archery?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, this whole thing is like, don't even think about the target.
Don't think about the target.
Which is, you know, I wonder if that's actually good archery advice. but yeah, like, you know, like
the irony of it all.
But I that book was formative for me in that. I was like, oh, like if I'm focused on selling a certain amount of copies, in some ways, aren't you selling yourself short? Like, aren't you going like the number is what matters? Like, shouldn't you be trying to reach as many people? Like, you know, I just try to think of like just doing it.
Just do it.
Nike. Yeah. Yeah.
Wait. All right. Last question. All right. What's winner of your life? Where that you'd like to improve in, that you're wide open to learning more about?
The big one I'm focused on, and I think Stoicism talks about probably more than just about anything, is just like temper. Like how do you control your temper? And the busier you are, and the harder you work, like it almost feels like the less control you have over that. So that's something I'm always sort of trying to work on, especially when you have kids, because it's like you see that it's not just you or other adults that you can potentially harm with this thing you don't control well, right? Mm-hmm. So definitely that.
Ah, well, good luck with that.
It's that's a life. That's a lifelong thing.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, Ryan? Thank you for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Is this my coin or I get
take it?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for the coin. Of course. I appreciate it. That was fascinating conversation.
Thanks. Yeah, this was awesome. Thanks.
Thanks. Hey, what's up, guys? Thanks for listening to Wide Open. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on all podcast platforms and hit me up on social media at TonyGonzalez88. Love to hear from you, answer any questions, and just wanted to say thank you.